From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're celebrating. First up, we're commemorating Sunshine Week. That's an annual event focused on the principles of open government, where we sing the praises of good policies and good politicians who strive for transparency, and the good work of journalists who dig in when those policies and politicians are not so open. We're also celebrating the joys of blurred culture, where the Black experience intersects with the nerdy, in a good way, worlds of comic books, sci-fi, anime, and classic kung fu movies. Later in the show, we'll share my colleague Aaliyah McConnell's deep dive into blurreddom. But first up, we gotta honor Sunshine Week. And here to help me do that is my colleague, Rachel Keith. Rachel, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So we are celebrating Sunshine Week. And in honor of this week of transparency, we're looking at policies around what local government employees can say. It's an issue we run into as journalists all the time. But it's not a niche issue. You actually crunched the numbers to figure out how many people we're actually talking about here.
Yes, between UNCW, CFCC, New Hanover County Schools, New Hanover County Government, and the City of Wilmington Government, we have just over 10,000 employees in those five government institutions.
So, yeah, a lot of people. As former State Treasurer Dale Falwell once told me, the largest employer in North Carolina is North Carolina, followed by the counties and local governments of North Carolina. So this is a lot of people. And the issue really is, it's very hard to avoid politics these days or issues that could be politicized. So if you're a government employee, what can you say? You know, either in your private life, on social media, what can you say to a reporter? If you're a subject matter expert, say you're a city planner, can you speak out on legislation that might change a city or town's ability to rezone an area? These are the questions we run into. We especially have run into this when it comes to university professors, obviously a hotbed of political issues. And so you sat down with the general counsel at UNCW to talk about some of this.
Yes, that's John Scherer, and he's what's called the campus's responsible officer for free expression. So this was mandated by the UNC System's Board of Governors, and he basically produces a report every year for the Board of Governors about speech on campus. And that includes student speech and employee speech and the types of events that they hold, kind of speakers that they have. So he is basically the person of free speech on UNCW's campus. So I put to him first, I had heard this over the years as a reporter. Some college professors are saying, wait, I don't have tenure. I might want to wait to talk to you until I have tenure. And I put this to John Scherer about some of those concerns.
Legally, they have more protections with tenure, meaning that you can't be fired unless for cause, and you have certain appeal rights that occur with that. But even people who don't have tenure are on contract. So during that contract period, they have protections of due process within that time period. How that affects their free expression, each faculty member has academic freedom and has rights of free expression in their classroom as well as outside of class. How they determine to use that, that's up to them. I don't know that individually, I haven't heard of someone saying, okay, I can't speak because I'm afraid something will happen to me in getting tenure.
So another question we had, and this has to do with recent changes to university policy, is how far can professors and other university staff members go when it's talking about hot button political issues? So the university system, UNC system, recently rolled out updated institutional neutrality policy. So how does this work?
Yes. What he said was that mainly the institutional neutrality policy is if you're speaking in your official capacity, that you might not want to take a position on race or politics or things that are mainly controversial. But at the end of the day, you know, researchers who are doing their research can speak on that. But here is John Scherer talking about this institutional neutrality.
We have obligations. You probably have heard of institutional neutrality. We're not, people in their official capacity are not allowed to take official positions that are on the issues of the day, shall we say, the way they have written it in the UNC policy is that it can't be related to sort of social justice activities or political activity. And that's really a free expression thing to ensure that we have a full marketplace of ideas here at the university, so we're not putting the thumb on the scale of one.
We've seen this play out in a number of different spaces, including how the university handles like student identity groups. You know, there was a time when there was a lot of pressure on the university as a whole and departments individually to say Black Lives Matter. And that would be banned under this policy. But they would be allowed to help students coordinate their own, you know, Black Lives Matter, you know, protest or march or event or something like that. So that's just one example of sort of that difference where you can't say, you know, if you're the dean of a college, you had this experience, Rachel, if you're the dean of a college, you can't say the College of Education or the College of Science feels this way about this issue. They might be able to say in my personal research or my personal opinion, but they've got to be pretty clear about that line.
Yeah, I think it is this official capacity or versus this is my research, this is my me speaking as a citizen, not as a professor of the institution. But I think, you know, they hear that and they say, okay, I probably shouldn't speak at all. But there are shades to this, you know, that, you know, again, if they do study it, they can speak on it because a lot of the times they are studying government policies and does this government policy work? Yes or no? And this is what I'm going to tell you about it, what I found out. So it's not like they're prevented from speaking on controversial issues per se, but again, they have to have some of that subject matter expertise in their back pocket.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken to folks at the UNC School of Government, which is part of the UNC system. In particular, we've done a few stories on criminal justice where there are pretty strongly diverging feelings about particular pieces of legislation. And so those professors have always been careful to say, this is my experience. These are the repercussions of the law, good, bad, or indifferent, instead of saying, you know, I'm advocating for this law to be struck down. And those interviews are crucial to the kind of reporting we do because we want those expert voices. I think some of the issue that reporters run into is when, like you said, folks feel like because it could be possibly construed as they were speaking on behalf of the university, they're just really hesitant to do that. Now, there is it's not a law or rule, but it's a piece of guidance that the university has when a reporter reaches out to, say, a subject matter expert about how they're supposed to handle it. What is the deal with this?
Yes, it's highly recommended that you talk to the Office of University Relations, OUR, all caps, and you need to let them know that you are speaking to the media on behalf of your subject matter expertise. And I kind of drilled down about this highly recommended. Yes, of course, the communications department wants to know what their, you know, the university staff is talking about. Same thing with other governments, but you don't have to, is what John Scherer said. And going back to our issue, I mean, I was really trying to drill down with him, like, what can they say? And so this is what John Scherer had to say on, you know, how faculty can present their research.
There's also a policy on advocacy for speaking to legislators. And one of the ways that our faculty often contribute is to testify before General Assembly or before Congress about research they've done. So that's permissible as well. I mean, they have an academic freedom to do research in whatever area of their choosing what they're doing, and they can speak about their research. And certainly within the classroom, it's sacrosanct as far as their ability to convey ideas and to determine how they're teaching their subject matter. What they're speaking about, you know, outside extramurally, shall we say, they have their own personal beliefs and they can certainly speak on that. As far as speaking about the research, sure, yeah, they can. I mean, if they research on social justice, they can speak on social justice.
And that kind of broad academic freedom is really like a crucial core tenet of Western liberalism. That's part of what makes the university so important. Yeah, they can go in front of Congress or the state legislator or come to the WHQR studios and talk to a reporter. I think we've seen a little bit of friction between the highly recommended and the mandatory where, you know, I've heard a few jokes about, you know, three-letter, all-caps agency names. But basically, it's a little intimidating if you are worried about crossing the line on your own. I feel like there's maybe some safety in going through the Office of Communication. I will say that there is a flip side of this, to be fair to the university. There are many times where I have spoken to a university professor and it's had nothing to do with the university. You know, we're talking about international terrorism or AI or biotech, stuff that doesn't reflect on UNCW or the UNC system. But there are also times when we've spoken to staff in a way that does maybe impact people who are on the board of governors, the board of trustees, where there is a real political valence to what they're saying. And in those situations, we would reach out to the university and the UNC system for a comment. We're never going to blindside them. It's never going to be breaking news, university professor says X about UNCW. But not every media outlet will work that way. And we do understand that they have a vested interest in making sure that they kind of know what's coming down the pike in terms of news coverage. That is, that's their prerogative, and we do get that.
Yeah, and I will say, you know, if you don't know who the subject matter expert, that organization is very helpful. Hey, do you know who could speak on this? You know, a lot of times public spending on education. Do you have an expert on this? This is, I'm doing a story. And usually when we're doing stories, we want the subject matter expertise. We don't usually want personal opinions when we're reaching out to professors in their subject matter area.
Right. All right. So let's move on a little bit to talk about New Hanover County, also a giant employer, and also a place where there are definitely employees who would speak to issues that could be hotly political. So you sat down with Josh Smith, who's the chief communications officer for the county.
Yeah, and they're a little different, right? They provide communications on hurricanes and how to fill out your taxes. So it's, you know, it's more of a broader public service that they are doing. And here's Josh on that.
Public information, in my view, is kind of the most critical component of a really great communications, I guess, suite of services or tools. Yes, we're going to facilitate media interviews. Yes, we're going to open access to county commissioner conversations, decisions, meetings. It's budget season, as you know. And so we're going to stream those meetings. We want a high level of access and transparency with everything that's happening in the government.
And the county has similar policies like UNCW. Hey, we want you to speak to media. We want you to speak to your expertise, and we want to help you in that. But a lot of times, yes, the communications department wants to be looped in so they know how information is flowing in and out of their institution.
Yeah, and Rachel, you and I were talking about this off mics before the show, is that we've had this experience with the county and the city and other governments. There's a balance to be had here. I think early in my career reporting on the city of Wilmington, there were times where the PIO, the communications officer at the time, would try to take my questions, take them to the subject matter expert, get an answer, and bring it back to me. And the PIO would try to put them in layman's terms, which I appreciated. But sometimes there was some game of telephone whisper down the lane errors that got into the signal. And on the other side of the equation, there were times where I sat down with subject matter experts and I misunderstood what they were saying, or I didn't understand how that fit into the broader picture of what the city or the county was doing. And so I've seen over the years, we've sort of gotten to this baby bear's porridge place where it's like, okay, maybe having the PIO in the room or being part of the signal chain is helpful, but also give us a chance to talk right to the expert. I mean, I think we're kind of getting to that place.
Yeah, a lot of times they want to email, right, responses. And then you read it and then you're like, I still have more questions. And then sometimes you pick up the phone and then they talk to you and you're like, oh, that's what's going on here. Like, yeah, we've had a conversation and now I get it. And now my reporting can be better and more factual and more robust because I really understand the nuances. You can't get that out of an emailed statement of Q&A.
Yeah. And I will say, you know, we've had our moments with the county, but in general, their policy has been fairly pro-transparency. And Josh spoke to that.
In today's world, I think it'd be safe to say that sometimes there's not a lot that folks can completely agree upon. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say, though, that transparency in government is one of those things that everyone can't agree on. They, you know, people want, expect, and deserve transparency from their local government.
Now, that is all well and good, but that is not always the case with government. We have all experienced being sort of blacklisted or, you know, stonewalled by local and state government or federal government. And we've also experienced times when there are employees who want to talk to reporters or to the public in general, but they can't because there's kind of a gag order. And you recently had a conversation about this, I think is kind of enlightening.
Yes. I talked to Catherine Foxhall. She was recently at the North Carolina Local News Summit that myself and Aaliyah McConnell and Nikolai Mather attended in at North Carolina Central. And she was on a panel talking about gag orders and public information officers. And she's a member of the Society of Professional Journalists. And she's been talking about a case for a while where a Pennsylvania journalist, she basically sued because she couldn't talk to any of the employees at the Allegheny County Jail. And that was including medical personnel there. And basically they were having an alarming number of deaths and injuries coming out of that jail. And so she couldn't do her reporting. And so this is what Catherine Foxhall is saying about the fallout of that.
And then at that point said, nobody on staff could talk about this. Of course, when you do this, it's not the reporter you're hurting so much as the entire public. And people should step back and understand that that entire public includes people in the agencies. I mean, if the people who are running the agencies, if everybody shut up, then nobody knows what is going on. Or there, I would say there are great holes in what all of us know is going on.
And I will say again, you know, you might see, oh, it's Rachel's report, it's Ben's report. But our values and our purpose is to represent and be a voice for the citizens, for the public. So that's why we're saying information is number one. The truth is number one to us. So we're going to get at it as much as we possibly can.
And behind almost every great Pulitzer Prize winning story, or even just every great local piece of hometown journalism you've seen, is probably a whistleblower, is probably someone on the inside who knew what was happening and wanted the public to know, for better or worse, what was going on, and reached out to a journalist and talked to them in some way. And that's why I think these policies are really, really important. The more clear they are and the more definite the lines are around what you can and cannot do, the more likely employees are to feel comfortable. Rachel and I have both had the experience of talking to people where we looked at the policy and said, yeah, you're in the clear. You can totally talk to us. They felt uncomfortable. And at a certain point, it is not our job to browbeat someone into being a whistleblower if they just don't feel comfortable. It's their life. It's their job. It's their employment. They've got a family. They've got a mortgage or rent that they've got to pay. And we ultimately have to and do respect that. So that's why I think these policies are so important to understand.
That's right.
All right. Well, this is, I think, an important issue. I'm glad we touched on it for Sunshine Week. If for no other reason that, as Josh Smith kind of alluded to, transparency might be one of the last great nonpartisan or at least bipartisan issues over the last 4 or 5 years. We've seen increased civic literacy in people on the right and the left and the center using their rights to do public records requests, to do FOIAs for the federal government, to get access to information that belongs to them so they can better understand the world they live in. And I think more transparency is always better. And that is one thing where it doesn't matter where I am and what side of the aisle I'm talking to people on. I always hear people say amen to that.
Yes, that is a talking point for any politician. I believe in transparency and accountability. If they follow through on that, we'll see.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, the proof of the pudding is in the giving us the documents.
Yes.
Yeah. So what were some of your key takeaways before I let you go?
So it looks like when I looked at CFCC, UNCW, and New Hanover County Schools, they have more in-depth speech policies than, say, New Hanover County and the city. When I look at retaliation in terms of speech, it really doesn't show up. It shows up when an employee might file a grievance or a Title IX report or a discrimination report. Harassment, that's when you'll see you will not be retaliated if you're going to file an official report within your agency, is what I see. I also see that government employees, if you're speaking for the government, you probably want to loop in, or at least your government agency trusts you to speak on the subject matter. If you're talking as a personal citizen, you can do that. But you need to say, I am speaking in my personal capacity, not as a government employee on this topic. So you have to differentiate what hat you're wearing. Employees can speak to the media, but it's highly recommended to go through their communications departments. CFCC, they say you cannot contact the staff without the knowledge of the marketing department. So there is that. Then you have the school system that says in their policy, if it's good or bad, the media can reach out to our staff and they can say that. But then it says, yes, it's recommended that you loop in your communications department. So that's interesting. I mean, they do have rights as citizens, and they also are employed by the agency, and they do have to conduct themselves to their standards of professionalism on the books.
All right. Well, Rachel Keith, thank you for giving us the lay of the land here. This is, as I said, a really important issue and a perfect issue for Sunshine Week. So thank you for being here.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're taking a deep dive into blurred culture and a guided tour of the three chambers. Don't worry, we'll explain what all that means. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. And if you want to support this show and the news team here at WHQR, I hope you'll make your way over to WHQR.org and make a pledge of support online. Thanks, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. As I said earlier in the show, this episode is all about celebrating. And now we want to focus on something a little different, the joys of being a blurred, or a black nerd. My colleague Aaliyah McConnell took a personal approach to blurred culture, reflecting on what it means to grow up at that particular cultural intersection, including an in-depth look at the Three Chambers Festival, an event in Wilmington created by documentarian Chris Everett that brings together fans of hip-hop, anime, and martial arts under the umbrella of blurredom. But Aaliyah tells the story far better than I can, so let me pass the mic.
At the tender age of 8, I ditched my Bratz dolls and abandoned the world of Kidz Bop after hearing Green Day's American Idiot for the first time. I found myself absorbed in a world of emo, screamo, punk music, and ever since, I accepted my fate as an emo kid. After school, I would ride around my neighborhood on my skateboard, blasting early Fall Out Boy through the headphones of my CD player. I would tune into Steven's Untitled Rock Show as soon as I completed the last of my multiplication homework, and I even had a shrine dedicated to My Chemical Romance hidden in my closet. I know, it's weird, right? Don't worry, everyone else thought so too. I was unlike any other little black girl I grew up with. At the best of times, I felt downright abnormal. At the worst, I scared my family so much that they would try to pray the evil spirits away. Well, 20 years later, I've come to terms with the fact that that's what makes me a blurred. A music blurred, but a blurred nonetheless. I'm criminal justice reporter Aaliyah McConnell, and I'm taking a break from my normal reporting to bring you a special story. By now, you may be asking yourself, blurred, isn't that just what happens when you take a bad selfie? Well, yes. But I mean blurred spelled B-L-E-R-D. It's actually a portmanteau of black nerd. The term sounds like something a bully would shout out on the schoolyard. But back in the early 2000s, all nerds, but blurreds especially, had to hide in the closet, unless they wanted to risk getting roasted by their classmates. Here's Michael A. Betts, an assistant professor of sound design at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington and self-proclaimed blurred, who worked on a series called Blurred Nation, explaining what being a blurred means to him.
I think in its finest form, it's somebody who has an expertise in something to the point where either A, you are correcting people with the actually designation. B, you can tell me this begets this, which begets this. Or C, you are able to speculate towards the future. So somebody like an Octavia Butler would be an Afrofuturistic blurred, but a blurred nonetheless.
Beth says the start of blurredom can be traced back to the 90s, but the term didn't really stick until the release of Black Panther in 2018. and he shares why.
I would argue that the reason that Black Panther becomes such a global phenomenon in the United States and in other colonized spaces, because I have friends from Africa who were very offended by the representation that happens there. But the reason that I think everybody else is so attuned to it, so keyed up by it, is because it launches for them the feeling of power.
He recalls the first time seeing the Black Panther trailer in theaters, and it went something like this.
Screen goes black, and we hear the and the dog comes, bark, 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 and like the light shines, and we see the mask of the panther, and it goes black again, bom, 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 bom. And then we hear, and it's like the gunshots, gunfire.
Beth said, as somebody who works in media, this was a very special moment for him.
And we see dude hit the car and slide down, and then from Legends Has It, and then we hear step into the spotlight.
Aside from the star-studded cast, much of the hype around Black Panther stemmed from it being the first Marvel franchise to feature a predominantly Black cast. And for many, it was the first time they got to see someone who looks like them star as the titular superhero in a movie. Betts recalls.
That's the first time we see Bozeman, like, out of the mask. We see Bassett. We see Nyong'o. We got Killmonger, Michael B. Jordan. Like, it's just like everybody's just lit. And I was just so keyed up because for me, I had never seen me look like that on screen. I was so blown away.
And since then, there's been a reckoning with the blurred revolution taking over the mainstream. Blurred-dom comes in many forms, Beth says, from sneakerheads to sports fans and even political pundits. But Chris Everett, who some may recognize as a documentarian who brought us the 2015 film Wilmington on Fire, is a different breed of blurred. He's one who loves anime, martial arts, and hip-hop. Growing up, Everett felt like he had to hide who he was, too. He understood that there were just some things you kept to yourself when Black culture was more demanding of conformity.
You know what I'm saying? And, you know, back when I was growing up, I used to get clowned. You know what I'm saying? So a lot of times we had to suppress and hide these type of things that we were interested in. I think more of the younger generation now, I think, you know, a lot of them are more embracing it.
Despite the cultural pressure to conform within the Black community, Everett now proudly shows his love for all things anime, manga, and cosplay.
I say, you know what? I want to embrace the things that I loved growing up, you know, that I had to hide growing up. But why should we have to hide that? And so I want to show that there is a cool blurred culture out here, you know, pretty much, and I'm a blurred all the way.
Over the last 2 years, in December, he's been organizing a four-day festival that combines all three forms of his blurred-dom together, called the Three Chambers Festival. In many popular spots around Wilmington, like Sokoto House and Waterline Brewery, have offered up their space for his cause. Everett is one of the first to introduce the city of Wilmington to blurred culture on this scale. Here he is, talking about the idea behind his concept.
And you're starting to see people like Megan Thee Stallion and other big stars are really embracing, you know, anime culture and all these cool things. You know what I'm saying? We're blending Black and Asian culture together. Everyone loves hip-hop, regardless of age, race, gender. A lot of people love martial arts. People love anime. So we get a very diverse crowd.
Everett has a lot of hopes for this festival. Education, platforming upcoming talent, and taking people through what he calls the three chambers of expression. That's art, music, and film. Don't ask me why he didn't add podcasts. That's on him. But let's journey together through the chambers, starting with the most mysterious and ephemeral. Art. Martial arts, that is. As Betts mentioned, a blurred is someone who can trace back the history of their particular interests. In this case, there are films and TV shows like Rush Hour, The Last Dragon, Afro Samurai, and The Boondocks that offer a peek into these cross-cultural influences. All of these works have something in common, the theme of martial arts. which Everett says has
always been embedded in our culture, but it's rarely talked about.
Of course, Three Chambers featured acts like Minds One, Justo Mobbin, and North Carolina-based poet L.J. Bowens, but the showcase of martial arts was in full force with a demonstration from Raleigh-based Panthers martial arts demonstration team. The group kicked, flipped, and broke wooden boards in half with their bare fists. But one of the highlights of the performance was the fusion of Taekwondo and hip-hop style dance. One of the demonstrators, Sage Battle, who specializes in Muay Thai, spoke about the balance of merging different styles of martial arts with dance.
So this has been a challenge for us because we're not only blending different styles, we're making a really meshed team, trying to, you know, be cutting edge while also honoring where we came from, what we grew up learning. So thank you so much.
DJ Two Tone of the group Shaolin Jazz, who we'll hear from again later in this story, explains how martial arts has always had an impression on hip-hop culture since the days of b-boys and breakdancing.
Yeah!
You know, yeah, breakers, like, incorporating some of these acrobatic, like, fight moves in their routines. And it was very common for somebody who was a breaker to, like, want to learn martial arts.
But even earlier than that, the art of battle dancing rose to prominence in Brazil, as enslaved West Africans in the region displayed a distinct style of martial arts known as capoeira. These sparring routines are distinguished by elements of percussive music and call and response singing, similar to today's breakdancing, says Two Tone.
Just even how that's set up is very hip hop. Like, it's like, you know, it's a breaker's circle, it's a cipher. You got two people in there and y'all are going at it. And there's still a mutual respect while it's happening too. But you're feeding off the energy, the cipher, and the music.
Everett points out that people of the African diaspora
always had a fascination with martial arts. So we want to do, you know, certain seminars and lectures about this topic. You know, how does hip hop and martial arts come together? How does hip hop and anime come together? And so we want to start educating the public that there's a long history to this connection.
That brings us to the next chamber of expression, one that connects people unlike any other, music. The cross-cultural influences of martial arts and Black music, especially hip-hop, have been embedded in our culture for decades. This legacy stretches from the ubiquitous earworm, Kung Fu Fighting, by soul singer Carl Douglas, a song that's been featured in dozens of TV shows and films since its release in the mid-70s, to one of the most notable acts that embodies this phenomenon, the Wu-Tang Clan. Everett said this is partly what Three Chambers is about, acknowledging the influence of this fusion in popular music, even pointing out that there are more rappers embracing this style, from chart-topping artists like Lil Uzi Vert, Megan Thee Stallion, to underground artists who are making big waves, like Kiko Black, who performed at the festival recently. Kiko's music features many references to her love for anime and gaming, with songs like Bunny Girl Senpai Freestyle and GTA. Even her Twitch handle, Kiko for Hokage, is a nod to the popular anime series Naruto. But it was the Wu-Tang Clan, a group highly inspired by kung fu flicks from the 70s and 80s, who set the trend.
On guard, I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
They were a big inspiration for Three Chambers. On the festival's website, it boldly states that the event is a tribute to the Wu-Tang Clan and the martial arts movie that inspired them, the 36th Chamber of Shaolin. Here's DJ Two Tone to offer a quick explanation of the significance of Shaolin to the Wu-Tang Clan.
So, just a quick overview for those who are not as familiar. Wu-Tang Clan, they are heavily inspired in terms of their names and, you know, just kind of their way of thinking and approach to music and sound bites and all that stuff. Heavily, heavily, heavily influenced by East Asian martial arts culture, and more specifically, kung fu flicks.
The docu-series, Kill a Hill, which follows the lives of Wu-Tang members and close friends who grew up in the Park Hill projects of Staten Island, premiered at Three Chambers. Here's DJ Two Tone again.
So, using the name Shaolin, when Wu-Tang was at the height of their popularity, they would refer to where most of them come from, which over the years in hip hop, Staten Island had been kind of the forgotten borough of New York, or was always the last borough to be shouted out at hip hop functions.
Gerald Barkley, the series co-director, said over the process of creating the series, he interviewed past and present residents of Park Hill Projects as they hearken back to their time spent in the forgotten borough. One former resident was rapper and actor Clifford Smith Jr., better known as founding Wu-Tang member Method Man. Through those conversations, Barkley learned of the many lives that were lost to street violence in Killa Hill, a.k.a. Shaolin.
I was able to get Method Man to tell some really personal stories, close personal friends that passed away, either got killed by the police or killed by other criminals, or killed by friends. You know, all centers around the destruction of a neighborhood during the crack epidemic.
New York in that time frame was a grungy place, he said.
I am bringing you in a dirty, pissy staircase. No. And bringing you into that world. It's deep, though. It's very deep.
Herman Dawson, the executive producer of the project, who also grew up in Park Hill, said he knows firsthand how tough it was growing up in that environment after losing his brother to gun violence when he was younger.
This is how members of the Wu-Tang Clan were actually forged. You don't live in Park Hill, you survive Park Hill. And so this story is, while it is unique to members of the Wu-Tang Clan and unique to myself, it's not unique to everybody else that lives in it. It experiences the same type of trauma and that they go through it.
As someone with close ties to Park Hill and the Wu-Tang Clan, DJ Ninth Prince remembers that tumultuous time, but tells WHQR about the fond memories he has of watching his older brother, RZA, another founding member of Wu-Tang, bring the group together for jam sessions in their apartment.
And just coming into the house, like 10 o'clock at night, you know, at the age of like 10 to 12 years old, and seeing old Dirty Bastard and Jizza and RZA and the one little, I think it was a two-bedroom, maybe one-bedroom apartment, and inside the living room, just recording, you know, drinking, smoking weed, and recording, you know, and having a good time. It was beautiful, because I remember when it wasn't nothing. You know, I used to tell people that my brother's gonna be a star one day, and Wu-Tang is gonna be worldwide, you know. So I always was a believer.
Everett is a believer as well.
And they were kind of like the first group to kind of take that love for the kung fu flicks and implement it in their music.
Through Three Chambers, he can pay homage to the Wu-Tang Clan and offer artists that are following in their footsteps a platform. But even before that, Everett said,
Black and Asian culture kind of came together through the Blaxploitation era.
All right, well, we need to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll hand it back over to Aaliyah McConnell to continue this deep dive into blurred culture and guided tour of the Three Chambers. I'm Ben Shockman. You're listening to The Newsroom. And if you want to support this show and the news team here at WHQR, I hope you'll make your way over to WHQR.org and make a pledge of support online. Thanks, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shockman. Thanks for staying with us. We return now to my colleague Aaliyah McConnell's deep dive into Black nerd culture and the art, music, and movies that make documentarian Chris Everett's Three Chambers Festival so engaging.
Now, we've reached the third and final chamber of this journey, to one of the most fascinating and powerful realms of them all, film. In the early to mid-70s, a wave of independent filmmakers were producing movies for a more urban audience, giving way to a new image of African Americans in cinema, This short-lived but prolific period has come to be known as the Blaxploitation era. These were films made predominantly by Black creators with Black audiences in mind. And the stories typically tackled the topics of crime, drugs, sex, and racial tensions. These films, including Shaft, Superfly, and Coffee, have garnered a lot of criticism, however. From a filmmaking standpoint, they're criticized for the stiff dialogue, bombastic and often incoherent plot lines, and overall low-budget production quality. But cultural criticism focuses on their negative portrayal of the Black community. The exploitation and Blaxploitation is earned by the perpetual display of stereotypes among harsher themes of domestic violence, prostitution, addiction, and the list goes on. A lot of these films drew inspiration from kung fu movies of that period, which faced similar criticisms of perpetuating stereotypes. But ultimately, it was the first time many people of color got to see themselves represented as the heroes of their own stories, as Everett points out.
We connected with those stories. It was about fighting oppression, you know, fighting against the system, doing some cool, you know, fighting techniques, you know what I'm saying? The guys like Bruce Lee, he would dress fly, you know, like the brothers, you know what I'm saying?
And for better or worse, many Black and Asian actors, directors, and producers built their careers during this era and had many people of color frequenting grindhouse theaters, Everett notes.
And then also a lot of people don't know this, that when the kung fu movie craze hit here, a lot of those movies, along with the Blaxploitation movies, were in our communities. You know, a lot of those movie theaters in the inner cities, we supported those movies. We supported the Blaxploitation movies. We supported the kung fu movies. And so we supported that industry.
According to DJ Two Tone of Shaolin Jazz, the movie from this period that captures the grindhouse experience the best is Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
One of the first full scenes of the movie is in a movie theater, and they're watching Bruce Lee enter the dragon. But the movie theater is like unruly. Like, you got people smoking weed and drinking and talking, and got the boom, but like, but they're into it. They're really into it.
Here's a clip from that infamous scene.
Am I the meanest?
Sure enough.
Am I the prettiest?
Sure enough.
Am I the baddest mofo low down around this time?
Sure enough.
Well, who am I?
Sure enough.
Who am I?
I honestly don't know of any other film, period, that actually captures a sense of that or a glimpse of what that was like.
Two Tone is one half of the record-spinning duo called Shaolin Jazz that travels nationwide sharing specially curated experiences to keep the spirit of that period alive. But let me pass the mic over to him for a proper introduction.
So, yeah, I go by DJ Two Tone Jones. I'm one of the co-founders of Shaolin Jazz, along with my partner, Gerald Watson. We create or kind of explore the intersections of hip-hop, jazz, and martial arts culture through unique content and the creation of kind of like unique engagements that we do. Definitely one of the more notable engagements is our Can I Kick It movie screening experience.
Shaolin Jazz brought their Can I Kick It experience to Wilmington with the screening of The Last Dragon. In fact, it was one of the main attractions on Three Chambers' 2024 lineup. The group has put their own unique spin on movies including Kill Bill, Black Panther, and of course, The Last Dragon, by removing the original movie score and mixing their own tracks over the film live. Here, take a listen to the original opening scene of The Last Dragon.
All pheasants must be embraced, for then, and only then, will you break through the wall of mystery to the glow.
Master, perhaps with more time to train. Master, I need more time.
I am no longer your master.
Now, listen to the changes made in DJ Two Tone's version.
All pheasants must be embraced, for then, and only then, will you break through the wall of mystery to the glow.
Master, perhaps with more time to train. Master, I need more time.
I am no longer your master.
As you can hear, The scenes are backed by hard-hitting beats, and the effects added to the dialogue embellishes special moments throughout the film. Two Tone said, it can take up to 2 weeks to remix a movie soundtrack. First, he tries to scrub as much of the original music from the film as possible.
People ask this from time to time, like, no, I'm not able to completely remove all the music from the original score of a movie before we do what we do.
The next step in the process is to mix the music scene by scene. Two Tone says it's tedious work trying to blend his remix soundtrack in with the dialogue and follow the action and mood on the screen at the same time. After 10 years of doing this, he says it's still a learning process, but he adapts by getting as creative as he can.
Each scene kind of dictates what, you know, what music is going to get played. It just really depends on like the mood and, you know, it's two folks that are, you know, kind of feeling one another and kind of a love scene or whatnot, then, you know, I'll find something that fits that.
Two Tone said bringing out the humor of certain scenes to present to today's audience can be a balancing act.
You know, I'm into comedy as well, so I can't help but to also use the music or the sounds that I put in there to, you know, show the humor in some of the things. You know, we try to even poke fun at things that might, again, we know is not politically correct today, you know. But we're also not, like, trying to give you the impression, like, it's okay.
Here's what DJ Two Tone mixed up for us at Three Chambers.
It's going to be a range of, you know, some hip hop, a little R&B, funk, soul stuff, and, you know, and a collection of that stuff that still, in my opinion, still complements like the era and, you know, of that movie as well. So, you know, you might hear a little Rick James, some, you might hear a little KRS-One, who knows.
Shaolin Jazz's presentation of The Last Dragon at Three Chambers Fest marked the 40th anniversary of the film, making the screening even more special. Even 80s heartthrob and star of the film, Tai Mok, made an appearance. Here's Tai Mok sharing what he thinks makes the film so iconic.
When you go into the place of the unknown and you're in a safe space, meditate, then you're able to let go of all the pretense and the holding on and the stress and the identity of who you think you are, right? So that's really what this is about, tapping into that, which is in the heart.
L.J. Bowens wrote a poem inspired by the film that I think captures Tai Mok's sentiment and encapsulates the importance of Three Chambers to blurreds everywhere.
True master is not made overnight. They are made by their vigorous training. And that's why the world tests us daily. To be black, you must know how to be able to speak without anyone thinking that your skin is a Trojan horse to a culture. However, we always look to find what makes us strong. And I found that in a film that taught me that you can be yourself by being humble, because the secret awaits eyes unclouded by ambition. So for those who are seeking a master, look within yourselves and realize that you have always been that last dragon.
As for Everett, he said part of the proceeds made from last year's festival will go to NC Arts Disaster Relief Fund to help artists impacted by Hurricane Helene. And in the meantime, he plans to expand Three Chambers to encompass gaming culture as well. And he'll be releasing a documentary about martial arts this year.
It's called Grandmaster, the Vic Morse Story.
That you can learn more about by visiting GM Documentary on Instagram. Thank you to Chris Everett and everyone who helped bring this story together. I'm Aaliyah McConnell. Thank you for listening.
All right. Well, that's just about all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to Rachel Keith, Aaliyah McConnell, and our trusty program director, Ken Campbell. Thanks also to you for listening during this, our spring pledge drive. It's your support that allowed us to launch this show 4 years ago, and it's been your continued pledges of support that let us keep the show going, expanding our news team to bring you more deep dives and important conversations. We hope you'll continue to support us here in the WHQR newsroom and head to whqr.org to make your pledge of support online today. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for your support and thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.